Thanksgiving Day Parade starts at 9 a.m. on Thursday, November 24th. Enjoy balloons, marching bands, floats, clowns, performances, and of course, Santa. The 2.5-mile route stretches from the Upper West Side to Midtown, starting at West 77th Street, ending at Macy's Herald Square on 34th Street. For more information, mevents@macys.com. If you have an event you'd like to share with us, please email cbb@wbai.org. For the WBAI Community Bulletin Board, I'm Francesca D'Alessio.
The time now is 6 p.m. Stay tuned for the Katie Halper Show here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Welcome to The Katie Halper Show. I'm your host, Katie Halper. You can hear The Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM or WBAI.org. On today's show, I speak to Karen Zellermeyer and Jamie Zellermeyer, the mother and daughter co-hosts of the podcast I Was Never There. But before that, I speak to Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna, who represents California's 17th District. He's a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and in the interview, I refer to the letter the Progressive Caucus released and then rescinded, which urged the Biden administration to pursue diplomacy with Russia over the war in Ukraine. This interview was conducted just before the Republicans officially won the House. Thank you so much for coming back onto the show.
Great to be back on.
So I guess congratulations are in order.
Well, thank you. I think it was a much better than expected performance by Democrats. Certainly excited that we kept the Senate, and the House remains very close. We're either going to come short just a few seats, and we have an outside shot still of being in the majority.
What do you think the Democrats needed to do better to have a more decisive victory?
Well, first, let's say what they did well. I mean, I think that the president put democracy on the ballot. We made the election about reproductive rights and choice. And those really resonated with people. People rejected election denialism. They rejected extremism. They rejected the extremism of a Republican Party that wanted to have no abortion, no exceptions for even rape and incest. So we came out on the mainstream of those issues. I said in a Boston Globe piece this morning that the Democrats need to continue to regain trust on the economy, and we need to emphasize how we're bringing manufacturing jobs back, what we can do to provide people with childcare. You know, Canada just passed a law, not more than $10 per day for any family, what we can do to increase the minimum wage. Those issues we have to continue to fight on, but I do give the president credit for helping lead us to this victory.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had a critique of the Democrats, New York Democrats. She said that I think policing was a big one. I think the choice among certain Democrats to validate Republican narratives and amplify Republican narratives on crime and policing, running ads on it, validating these narratives actually ended up hurting them much more than a different approach. I think what we saw in other races was that they were able to really effectively center either their narratives and the narratives that they wanted to run with, whether it was abortion rights, whether it was democracy, whether it was, you know, other key and top priorities. I think Democrats in New York, they did a couple of things. They ran ads around that were explicitly very anti-defund, which only served to reinvoke the frame and only served to really reinforce what Republicans were saying. If we're going to talk about public safety, you don't talk about it in the frame of invoking defund or anti-defund. You really talk about it in the frame of what we've done on gun violence, what we've done to pass the first gun reform bill in 30 years. Our alternatives are actually effective electorally without having to lean into Republican narratives. So that, I think that was one prime mistake. Do you think that applies at all to the national level?
I don't think so. I think that people like John Fetterman, Tim Ryan, Mandela Barnes, and others around the country ran effective campaigns. They did focus on democracy. They did focus on abortion rights. And on public safety, they had common sense positions. They said, yes, we need to fund police, but we also are for reforms, and we are for ending gun violence by sensible reforms on gun violence. So I think that we have examples of candidates who did it well across the country.
Reading a Washington Post headline, federal judge in Texas strikes down Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. What should Biden and the lame duck Congress do about student debt ASAP?
Well, we should do legislatively anything that we can to codify the president's decision. We can do that with the House and Senate majority that we have. And so that is something that we should be pushing for. In addition to that, we need to make sure we're increasing the debt ceiling so that the Republicans don't try to hold the Biden agenda hostage.
Going back to the AOC tweets, so apparently Rep. Sean Maloney said about AOC, the last time I ran into AOC, we were beating her endorsed candidate 2-1 in a primary, and I didn't see her 1 minute of these midterms helping our House majority. She wrote back, let's make something crystal clear. SPM courted me for, that's Rep. Sean Maloney, for donations to swing races, and it was the first thing I did this term, over $250,000 for Dems this cycle. DCC, DCCC facilitated some, and now he denies it. If he isn't aware of my visit to California and efforts we put in, that's on him. So is there a war between the more progressive elements of the party and the more centrist elements?
I don't think so. Partly victory has many parents, and the reality is that we did very well for a midterm. Odds-defying results, you know, holding the Senate, coming within a few seats probably in the House. And so, you know, I think overall there is a large sense that we just want to get more of our agenda done, get child care passed, get minimum wage increased, do something on Wall Street, buying up single-family homes, make sure that we're bringing manufacturing back. Most people want to see what more of the Biden agenda and the progressive agenda we can get accomplished.
And what else could be done now about abortion rights, for instance?
Well, codifying Roe versus Wade is what needs to happen. And I think we have to keep voting on it. I mean, look, if the Republicans can vote 100 times to repeal the Affordable Care Act, we should vote 100 times to codify Roe versus Wade. And we need to make it clear how extreme the Republican position is. It's not just that they're banning abortions before 15 weeks or 6 weeks. They're saying no exceptions for rape or incest. And they keep citing these European laws. But if you look at the European laws, well after 15 weeks, you can still get abortions for multiple reasons, for socioeconomic reasons, for health reasons. So there's no comparison with what they're doing. And I think we have to continue to point out that their position is really way outside the mainstream.
You and Katie Porter and Takano introduced a bill to rein in rent gouging by wealthy corporate landlords. Can you talk about that?
Now, what's going on in this country is totally wrong. I mean, Wall Street is buying up single-family homes, and they're taking them out of the market. They're holding them, turning them either into Airbnbs or for places for rent, and that is driving up home prices. We weren't intended to be serfs to Wall Street. I mean, the dream here is to own your own home or to rent, but not to be paying rent to Wall Street. And so we end the Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae subsidies for Wall Street to buy up single family homes. And we say Wall Street can't be sitting on these homes after 18 months. There's a tax, and so that you don't have them just buying up and hoarding housing.
And what else would you like to tell viewers and listeners about that you're working on or that you're urging Democrats to do? Or,
well, we have, you know, a Boston Globe op-ed out this morning, I hope people will look at it, which says we really did a great job running on democracy and reproductive rights, but we are losing 15-20 points on the economy, and we've got to keep driving home the economic message by delivering on the economic message. That means a real agenda to bring manufacturing back and jobs back and production agenda. It means, which will also lower inflation. It means having $15 minimum wage, having childcare in this country, dealing with the housing issue, dealing with gas and the big profits of big oil. I do think these next 2 years, we have to articulate a clear and strong economic message.
Yeah, it seems like from polls, and of course polls only count so much, but it does seem like the economic message is much more of a priority than democracy for voters.
Well, I mean, look, I think the results said that the democracy mattered because people weren't going to vote in election deniers, even if they were upset that they were paying $5 for gas and weren't getting a raise. And that's a credit to the American people that they rejected that extremism. But I think to build a large majority and to build an enduring majority, we need to win on the economic issues. And there's no reason we can't. We just have to be on the side of the working and middle class and drive that message through.
And what can be done about inflation?
Well, the biggest thing, 63% of Americans blame inflation on the lack of supply chains here, the lack of manufacturing here. So we need to make more things in America. The semiconductors that we're making now because of the CHIPS Act will help. Building, making more masks, making more products will help. And then we have to go after big oil and the profiteering. I mean, corporate profits are a record high. We should be having a windfall profits tax for companies like big oil that are fleecing the American public. We should stop Wall Street driving housing inflation by buying up single-family homes. Those are two things that would reduce costs for Americans. We should make it childcare universal. If a person's paying more than $10 for childcare, the government should make sure that's not the case, like in Canada. That would really help many working families and middle-class families in this country.
Richard Wolff, the economist, cites Richard Nixon, of all people, implementing a price freeze. Do you think that's something that would be helpful?
No, I mean, Nixon made inflation much worse, and it led to one of the worst inflations that ultimately Paul Volcker had to come in to cure, because with the price freeze that led to further shortages, and we remember in the 70s lines at gas stations. So I don't think we need to have price freezes, but there are a lot of measures we could take short of that that would have an impact.
Okay. And why didn't the Progressive Caucus endorse Jessica Cisneros and Nina Turner?
Well, look, anytime I did endorse Nina Turner the first time when it was an open seat, and I stayed out the second time, and I had explained that to Senator Turner. But anytime you have a race against a sitting colleague, it's very, very hard to endorse against that, for especially for a caucus, which requires broad consensus amongst many members. Now, I think that the DCCC and the party should not put their weight on the scales. I don't think we should back incumbents. But I think if a stance of neutrality is perfectly reasonable. I mean, it's too much to expect that the caucus is going to be endorsing challengers to sitting incumbents.
Do you plan to make a run at Speaker of the House if the Dems do eke out a win?
No. I think there are people who are better positioned for that in terms of having the votes. But I'd love to see some progressive run for leadership, and they'd certainly have my support if they espouse good progressive values, Medicare for all, a free public college, the key universal child care.
Going back to the question of endorsing incumbents, though, it seems like with someone like Cisneros, who is a pro-choice candidate, challenging an incumbent who is anti-choice and also has an A rating from the NRA, shouldn't progressives back the person who's actually not just progressive, but when it comes to abortion rights within the mainstream of the party?
In general, I think absolutely in open seats. And if members want to do it individually and in races, they can. I think as a progressive caucus, though, we tend to not back candidates against incumbents. And the reason for that is you have to work with incumbents all the time with different legislation. But what I'm not for is for the DCCC to actually start helping the incumbent or endorsing it and putting resources behind the incumbent. I said, let those races just be fought out and let the voters decide without the party tipping the scales.
What happened with that letter that was released by the Progressive Caucus that Pramila Jayapal then walked back and basically rescinded? You were one of the only people who stood by it and defended it, which was kind of shocking because all it was calling for was diplomacy. It wasn't canceling anything, any support. It wasn't doing anything really remarkable at all. What can you talk about? What happened? Like, why was the letter released when it was? Was it really the mistake of staffers?
Well, I think the letter was common sense. I mean, all the letter said is that we stand by Ukraine. Putin's war was illegal. We will continue to support Ukraine, but we need to have diplomacy at the same time to prevent an escalation of the conflict, to prevent nuclear war. And now we see the generals are coming out in the front pages of the New York Times basically saying the same thing. We see that the administration actually now is engaged in a dialogue with their counterparts in Russia to prevent escalation. So I proudly stood by the letter. I think there was a moment of panic probably 2 weeks before the election that somehow this was going to have an outcome impact. Obviously, it had no outcome impact. And I wish more people had just stood by the letter.
And why do you think they didn't?
I think there was a, you know, there was a large concern 2 weeks before the election that no one wanted to jeopardize the chances of the party or show that there was any discord. But what I said is I don't think anything in the letter was inconsistent with the approach that the president would take. And it seems like I've turned out to be right on that approach, given that the administration is engaging in some of these dialogues. The generals are recommending that course of action. And certainly I think that the staff of the CPC has done an excellent job. And I don't think any staff person should be to blame for decisions of members of Congress to sign a letter and make a judgment about a foreign policy issue.
Were you aware of the story that Boris Johnson basically scuttled negotiations between Russia and Ukraine? Had you heard this story?
I've heard reports about it. It wouldn't surprise me that he hasn't played a constructive role in the conflict, but I don't know anything beyond just the news reporting.
Right. Do you think, I mean, it seems unlikely that he would have done that without Biden's okay. Have you ever, would you ask Biden about that or the administration about that?
I doubt that he would have had any okay from the administration. I mean, Boris Johnson is hardly someone that the United States is going to trust on much about anything, given how erratic he's been. So I think he's probably was just a free ranger on that issue.
You passed legislation banning assistance to Azov, the Azov Battalion. Is that still in effect?
I assume so. I mean, that was basically ensuring that none of the aid went to the Azov Battalion, and it passed overwhelmingly in the House. And I assume that the State Department has considered that and taken steps to make sure that that's not happening. But that doesn't mean that we don't stand up for the sovereignty of Ukraine just because there may be 1 or 2% of the country's military that has those issues or battalions that have those issues. Of course, we need to stand with Ukraine against Putin's illegal and unprovoked war.
Right. But are you worried about where these weapons are winding up?
I'm concerned. I'd want to make sure that the State Department has the best protocols they can. But I also understand that this is a very difficult situation with Putin having blatantly violated Ukraine's sovereignty, and that the highest priority is to make sure that Putin's aggression is pushed back. And then in that context, we need to do whatever we can to make sure that the arms aren't getting into the wrong hands. But I realize that that's difficult in a war that is Putin's fault.
And how do you think the case can be made to your fellow progressives that diplomacy and negotiation should be pursued? I mean, to me, it just seems like if you care about Ukrainians and Ukrainian civilians, the priority would be bringing the war to an end, since all wars end through negotiation and diplomacy anyway. It's just a question of how many people die before that happens.
Well, I think we have to give the example of the Cold War. I mean, even when we were at the height of the Cold War opposing Russian aggression into Afghanistan, we still had conversations with the Russians, and in part that led to the Russian withdrawal in Afghanistan. And so if we want Putin not to escalate this war, if we want to make sure that he doesn't mobilize from 300,000 troops to 3 million, if we want to do things that prevent him from systematically targeting utility and electricity in Ukraine. Obviously, we have to support Ukraine. We have to make sure that they have arms. But we also have to engage in negotiations for deconflicting and de-escalation.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Katie.
You're listening to The Katie Halper Show. I'm your host, Katie Halper. You can hear The Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM or WBAI.org. That was Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna, who represents California's 17th district. Next, I speak to Jamie Zellemeyer, producer and storyteller, and her mother, Karen Zellemeyer, an activist, who co-hosts the podcast I Was Never There. Named a 2022 audio selection at the Tribeca Festival, I Was Never There takes listeners on a trip into the countercultural movement swirling through West Virginia in the 1970s and 80s. Jamie Zellemeyer and her mother Karen investigate the shocking disappearance of their friend Marsha Mudd Ferber and explore her evolution from suburban housewife to back-to-the-land hippie to drug-dealing bar owner. As mother and daughter venture deeper into the mystery of Marsha's disappearance, the two process their own history. Jamie reflects on her non-traditional upbringing, and Karen reckons with the joyful and complicated consequences of her decisions. Also, they just released a bonus episode with Zaid Ayers Dorn and Bernadine Dorn of the podcast Mother Country Radicals about the weather underground. So be sure to check that out. And you can find I Was Never There wherever you listen to your podcasts. Jamie and Karen Zellemeyer are mother-daughter collaborators. Jamie is a producer, studio executive, New York Women in Film and Television president, and parent activist. Karen is an artist, writer, and professional lesbian who worked on LGBTQ issues for decades. And they are talking about their award-winning podcast, I Was Never There, which looks at what happened to their friend Marsha Mudd Ferber, a rock club owner and low-level drug dealer who went out for an errand in 1988 and never came back. So, Jamie and Karen, welcome. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Of course, yeah. So, this is a great podcast. I really enjoyed it. I binged on it. I binged listened to it. And we have a trailer. Should we play the trailer so people get a sense of what this podcast is about?
In 1985, Marsha Mudd Ferber took the stage at the Underground Railroad, a bar she owned in Morgantown, West Virginia, to hold an election.
Let's hear it from Ronald Reagan. Would you vote for Harriet Tubman? Yeah! Right. Harriet Tubman is president of 123 Pleasant Street, Morgantown, West Virginia.
Marsha was a political radical and a hippie with a flair for the dramatic.
The first time I saw Marsha, she was walking down High Street singing at the top of her lungs, "Let's get drunk and screw."
Everywhere Marsha went, she built community.
You know, she was all about redistribution of wealth. She'd share her panties.
She raised the consciousness of West Virginia.
And then, one day in April 1988, she disappeared.
Marsha was last seen April 25th. All that was missing was her backpack. Her car was left at a parking meter. Belongings left in an apartment above the bar.
I'm Jamie Zellemeyer. I was raised communally by a bunch of hippies who had a lot of fun and did a lot of drugs. That's how I knew Marsha. Growing up, she was like a second mom to me.
And I'm Karen Zellemeyer, Jamie's back-to-the-land hippie mom. Marsha was one of my best friends.
We've decided to go back in time, talking to people from her past and ours, to try and figure out what happened.
But the more we spoke to people, the more I realized there was a lot going on that I knew nothing about.
She was possibly murdered by some drug dealer types.
The pot business funded everything.
We were in South America, Marsha and I. We were in trouble.
This podcast is about Marsha Ferber.
But it's also about us.
So I've said this about a million times, but what were you thinking?
I wasn't, but would I do anything differently? I'm almost embarrassed to say probably not.
This is I Was Never There. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So really enjoyable podcast, a kind of cool mix of true crime and also mother-daughter discussions and family issues come up. But what made you guys do this in the first place?
Well, I work in film and television, so I am a storyteller, and I had always wanted to tell the story of the time and the place, which was West Virginia in the 1970s. And I just always loved the story of the Back to the Land movement and sort of what my parents experienced at that time and the hope that they had in the 1970s. But to tell a story, you know, you need hooks and you need good stories. And Marsha was such an important part of my upbringing and of my childhood. So I just felt like it was a good way. Doing the podcast was a really good way to tell both parts of those stories, because she was also a Back to the Land hippie and they just really worked together. And I always knew it was my mom's story to tell. I was kind of there to help her tell it and to tell my part of it. But it always felt very organic that we would both tell it together.
And here, I'm just showing some photos. Here's you and your mom.
That's in West Virginia. My parents moved back to the land when I was 10 days old to Braxton County, West Virginia.
And you're 9 months old in that picture.
And my mom was 24 when she had me, which is, you know, back in the 70s. Maybe that's when people had kids. But my mom was pretty young when she took this big leap of faith and moved to West Virginia, to the middle of nowhere with a 10-day-old baby.
And so, Karen, what made you want to tell the story?
Well, I've always shared Jamie's interest in really talking about the Back to the Land movement and a time when like, we had hope. I mean, we really thought we could change the world. And I'm not sure that that's how people feel these days. So trying to put that out and inspire risk-taking for me was a big part of it. And then the other big part of it was really being able to do something with my kid.
And what is the Back to the Land movement? Because that was something that was cool about this. It has like a bit of a mystery, but then it also explores different movements. And it's just a cool historic lens.
You know, it's funny. I'm actually going to let Jamie explain that. But what's funny is we were guest speakers in a class at Hunter College about podcasting. And we started with talking about hippies and the Back to the Land movement. And these young kids didn't know what a hippie was, didn't know what the Back to the Land movement was. It was like, so for me, that was like, oh, wow, we really got to build a different foundation here to talk about this. So what was the Back to the Land movement, Jame?
The Back to the Land movement was a time when I think people felt dissatisfied, or it was a way of life, of a feeling of dissatisfaction, of a way, a feeling of like, of the cities just were very much based on money and greed and capitalism. And it's funny, some of the issues are the same. It's about the environmental movement, the green movement, capitalism. And so it was people who decided that they wanted to move out of cities, move more rural, and live off the land, grow their own food, in some cases have their own animals. I'd say in the 70s, it was a little more, some of it was probably more organized. You know, some places were more organized than others in terms of communes or not communes, and how, you know, where was your money collected collectively? How did you make money? What kind of jobs did you have? But I think it was really an ethos or a sort of a feeling of the cities were not working. And there was too much greed, and we needed to live a different way that was more sustainable.
Yeah, you know, I was in college and grew up, my younger activism years was with the formation of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, right? And at a certain point, there was a real split in that movement. And there was a whole arm of that movement that was really making the decision to take up arms, right? The Weathermen. And to me, that was crazy. And to a whole segment of our population, there was no way you would ever convince me that the public was really just ready for some vanguard to take the lead and everybody would pick up arms, right? It was just, they were out of their minds, quite frankly. And maybe we were a little bit too in thinking that another alternative to that was really saying we reject it, but we've got to present something positive. And so this idea of going back to the land, I think in the podcast, we talk about tearing systems down to the studs and rebuilding. And that's what we thought we were doing. And one of the problems was that there was this Back to the Land movement. Unfortunately, there were some of us who came to it with that ideology, but there were other people who came to it because they liked to smoke weed and get high, which we like to do too. But there was a political ideology underneath what we were doing. And for some, there just wasn't. And that lack of a common ideology, I think, was ultimately a fatal flaw.
You're listening to The Katie Halper Show. I'm your host, Katie Halper. You can hear The Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM or WBAI.org. I'm speaking with Jamie Zellermeyer, a producer and storyteller, and her mother, Karen Zellermeyer, an activist, who co-hosts the podcast I Was Never There, which you can find wherever you listen to your podcasts. So tell us about Marsha. And tell us about how you met her and anything else that you want to let people know. I mean, it's another thing I just have to say. It's so fascinating that this was such an incredibly successful podcast. Like, I don't mean this as an insult, but if you had told me about this podcast idea, I would have been like, oh, that's interesting. I want to listen to it. But I never would have guessed it would have been like the top 20 podcasts.
Well, that takes a lot of work. A lot of work.
And it's really well done. But obviously you can have a well done podcast, but if there's not a there. You know, it's just interesting that this resonates with so many people, and most people didn't do Back to the Land. They wouldn't even consider themselves interested in that. So there's something. Tell us about Marsha's character, because that must be part of it.
That is a piece of it. But the other piece of it that really seemed to resonate with people, and then I'll go back to Marsha, was about the mother-daughter dynamic, right? And that whole processing, you know, all those times when Jamie would look at me like, what were you thinking?
That was one of the funniest parts. Like, I was laughing out loud when Jamie was like, wait, you did what? And even there's one part, I didn't want to give it away, but I think I'll just hint at it. But you almost get major legal trouble because of drugs. And then you have a lawyer who helps you out, and then you owe him money. So what do you, to pay him back, you?
I do more drugs. I carry drugs onto an airplane, like a lot of drugs.
She sends them through the security conveyor belt in her backpack.
5 pounds in a backpack in an airport. Really strong smelling.
Not now, though. Not in 2022 when cannabis is legalized. This is, you know, 1980, 81, 82, like thereabouts, 82. Not the same time period. This was from Florida, too. This was a very good friend of my mom's, was a big Jamaican pot dealer. So she went down and helped him out and traveled back. It was from Florida. They lived in Miami, and it was from Florida to New York.
Well, it was Jacksonville, actually. We were in Jacksonville. But
there you go.
So Marsha was my, my soul. So we went down to West Virginia in 1973 from New Jersey. She and her crew went down in 1975, so a couple of years after us. And in those days, we had no idea that there were any other groups like us anywhere other than the people who lived in our vicinity and in the vicinity where they were, which was really just like one county over. There were a whole number of little communes. And at a certain point, it became, she wasn't just a revolution, she was a visionary. And she was someone who had great ideas about everything, how to make money, how to whatever, you know. And so they came up with this idea of starting a food co-op, but not just a food co-op. They had started a food co-op in their little county, but they started a federation of food co-ops called the Federation of Ohio River Cooperatives. And so I met them in Columbus, Ohio at a meeting of all these co-ops. And I became one of the facilitators of this big gathering. But Marsha, she agreed to be the president of this federation as long as it came with no power or responsibility. But she just was always brimming with ideas and not afraid of anything. And I loved that and felt a real kinship to that. And with that, so.
And then we eventually moved into, she owned a communal house in Morgantown, West Virginia, which is where she ended up. And we, my mom, my sister and I, my dad at another time, and I lived in the earth. It was called the Earth House. And it was kind of a suburban house, but with many rooms. And it was a shared kitchen. And Marsha was the owner of this house. She eventually moved into the buildings where her bars were, the Underground Railroad and the Dry House. But my mom put herself through graduate school working at the Underground Railroad, which was Marsha's bar. And Marsha became sort of a center of a cultural icon of West Virginia, and a lot of big bands played at her venues. But really, she was a mother figure. She took in wayward teenagers who felt awkward and like they had nowhere to live or nowhere to be. And in these pictures, she disappeared when she was 47 years old. And we always talk about how she seemed so old when I was a kid because she has gray hair. Of course, you know, I don't need to say my age, but I also have gray hair. But it's just looking at this photo of her with gray hair, you have to think she's 46 in this picture, probably 45, 46. And she did a lot of great stuff. And she was also, as you said, she was selling weed to support the businesses. And we don't know exactly how much we, you know, it was bigger than we imagined. And one day she disappeared.
It was a lot bigger than we imagined. And part of what I've had to reckon with, and I think a lot of people in my generation have had to reckon with, is we thought we were so, I don't know, we thought we were wild, but it became reckless. Wasn't just, you know, I still value being a risk taker. I want to be a risk taker. I want you guys to be risk takers because God knows we need people taking risks if we're going to make change. But her risk taking became really reckless. One might say that my carrying 5 pounds of pot onto an airplane was a little reckless as well. And I would agree with that. But she became reckless and it got her killed.
Well, we don't know that.
I believe it got her killed. We don't know for sure.
And you have to listen to the podcast. There are a lot of theories. It's hard. You just believe all. We have believed every single theory and many things could have happened.
And what is the thing that, I guess, shocked you most when you were working on this? Either about, for you, Jamie, it may have been something that your mom did, or maybe it was just something you learned about Marcia. And what about for you, Karen?
I mean, we didn't know the drugs were, I mean, I knew because I grew up in this world and smoking pot around kids was never a big deal. It was like people did drugs. I mean, there were a lot of drugs around, a lot of drinking, a lot of parties. I never thought of them as anything bad. It was fun. We were kids. It was enjoy, you know, it was fun. But some of the stories that we heard and some of out of country, you know, international stuff, we did not know. And, you know, I do think sometimes like, yeah, well, I was a kid. All that stuff was going on around, you know, me and around a lot of other kids, you know, and some kids did better than others sort of as they grew up. But it was pretty wild. And I think it was probably in her case a little more wild than we knew, or a lot more. I mean, there is so much I'm sure we don't know.
What was the story that you told Jamie where you were like, as a little kid, you were pantomiming smoking? Can you share that story?
In our family, it's like funny. Like everyone thinks it's funny. Like I was in preschool with a couple other friends that were sort of also back to the land kids, 4 years old, sitting around, I don't know if it's tea time or what, you know, what circle time. And we are all pretending to pass around a joint at the age of 4. Our friend Patty, who's in the podcast, she worked there, as did another friend of ours. And also another woman who worked there who was married to one of the state troopers. But in our like communal family, this is a funny story, but I had to really look at some of the stories that we talked about and realize that not everyone was going to find them funny and kind of think about it and think about these things in context, because 4 year old sitting around smoking pot is probably not that funny, but they just thought it was cute and funny. And it is kind of funny.
Well, miming smoking pot, right? You weren't actually.
We weren't actually, although in my memory, kids did steal from their parents.
Oh, you were not 4 years old when you were stealing weed from your parents. You were a teenager in the East Village when you were stealing weed from your parents. Just saying.
But other kids, I believe, were stealing from their parents at pretty young ages. There was a lot of drug abuse for sure. And it wasn't hidden. Most of it wasn't hidden. I did steal from my mom when I was in, I don't know, junior high school, starting in junior high school. But you just left in like a sock drawer.
Oh, the pot?
Yeah. It wasn't very well hidden.
What were some of the things that you miss about that life, Karen or Jamie?
You know, I'm still trying to create the commune. I still long for kind of a collective communal life. I'm not sure I ever successfully You know, there were moments, again, first of all, I think drugs, and when I say drugs, I don't mean pot, but drugs are not good. They are not good. And I think they really contributed mightily to the inability to create the kind of life we were trying to create. And again, I can't repeat enough, that's lack of a common ideology. So for some of us, we were there because we were rejecting of capitalism. We were rejecting of a patriarchal model of relationship, which we completely fell into anyway when we were there. Everything that was going on there, it's so much worse now, but it's exactly the same. But what became known, and why I think one of the reasons Jamie and I were so interested in doing this story and doing something on TV or a movie about it, is because it has been so trivialized and it has been so cliched and so stereotyped as this, you know, bell-bottom, peace, love, and understanding, let's all get high and love each other, without any of the depth of what was behind it. And it was drugs that really, really f***ed it up.
And I would say, too, just quickly, I mean, one of the beauties of working in podcasting in audio is that you don't have the vision, you know, in an interesting way, coming from film, actually, is like being able to tell a story without the visuals was really an interesting challenge. And I thought it was a nice way to tell the story of the 70s and 80s, because you had to do it through real storytelling and create the visuals through the audio, which is just interesting as a content creator. And I would say one of the things that I don't know if I miss it, but one of the things I appreciate about that time and about the way that my parents lived was this idea of, it's not, I feel like, over everything now, as I do as a parent and in 2022, and, you know, I live my nice life in Brooklyn, and everything's about, like, what school are my kids going to go to, and where are we going to live, and what's everything going to look like day to day, and so overthought. Am I going to spend $100 on these tickets for a concert? And it's just, I feel like there was a freedom of thought and a freedom to not overthink. And I've tried to learn from that when I can.
You're listening to The Katie Halper Show. I'm your host, Katie Halper. You can hear The Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM or WBAI.org. I'm speaking with Jamie Zellermeyer, a producer and storyteller, and her mother, Karen Zellermeyer, an activist who co-hosts the podcast I Was Never There, which you can find wherever you listen to your podcasts. And Karen, you came out while living there, right?
I did.
Do you think you would have come out later on in the real world, or?
I think I was probably destined to come out.
Did this make it easier to do than you think it would have been?
No, well, I don't know. I think, you know, actually, I think what made it easier probably was that both of my parents were dead.
Interesting.
And I was no longer needing to live up to their ideal of the, you know, lefty, radical, the politically radical and culturally conservative person. So that liberated me quite a bit. But no, it was actually harder there. We were a really small, close community with a bunch of macho guys, you know, who had their chainsaws and their pickup trucks, and they were hippies. But nonetheless, we were supposed to be home and taking care of the kids.
But, I mean, there was free love, which probably lent itself a little bit to...
Yeah, it was still border crossing. It was boundary crossing. We were supposed to sleep with anybody we wanted to, as long as it was of the opposite gender, right? Or unless it was a threesome. That was fine.
Those are the good old days.
We were pretty ostracized.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. When Patty and I first got together, oh, yeah, the guys, they lost their minds. They couldn't.
So it was not free sex. It was free sex among some people.
It was free heterosexual sex. Yeah, that's changed a lot.
Speaking more of the politics, I mean, there's a scene involving the KKK. So can you talk about those cultural political clashes?
Yeah, well, we were, it's, you know, again, we Marcia and I and our friends were very politically engaged. And the state, which was a pure, believe it or not, West Virginia was a blue state when we lived there, even though the culture wars were beginning. In 1973, there was the Great Book War, right, where they were trying to ban books from the school curriculum.
The Great Textbook War.
The Great Textbook War. So it was all certainly beginning to happen. And we talk about that in the podcast as well, how the state began to change. But the KKK came to town for a conference outside of Morgantown. And I mean, should I tell the story of Marcia and another friend of ours just couldn't stand the idea that the KKK was just there and outside the campground, they had this huge cross erected. And so Marcia and our friend Michelle drove out there in this little Volkswagen with a couple of thermoses of supposedly coffee. And Marcia looked very Jewish, but Michelle was a 6'2" blonde, blue-eyed woman who, as she says, it always terrified her that she looked like she fit right in that environment. But they go into this campground where they're all camped out and kids are doing target practice with the targets. Or there's three targets, a homosexual and a black person with big lips and a Jewish person with payas. And these little kids with toy guns doing target practice. So Marcia and Michelle start walking around with their thermos and offering the adults coffee because it's a cold, rainy night there. And they explain to the people they give the coffee to that they shouldn't give it to any of the children because there was alcohol in it. It was like mixed with some whiskey or something.
But it was spiked. It was spiked with LSD.
So they got this whole campground high on LSD and then snuck out and pulled down the cross and dragged it off with their Volkswagen. And the campground broke up 2 days early. So they were very proud of themselves.
But everything was about politics. I mean, that's how I felt growing up. I mean, there were all these, there were the drugs and there was the communal living, but it was all, but for my parents and their friends, it was all political. I mean, they were in political plays. Marcia held political benefits. We lived communally. We went to every march in Washington. My mom's been arrested for civil disobedience. I don't know how many times. I mean, everything was about the politics.
We actually have a video of Marcia making a sort of political speech. This is at the
Underground Railroad.
This is at her bar, and she's throwing a party during, I think, Ronald Reagan's second inauguration, where she's nominating somebody else to be president.
Sorry about the cold. I hope it's this cold in Washington, D.C. tomorrow.
Yeah! Even colder!
How is it cold in D.C.?
All right, last year, all of, what, Robert?
Put your mouth closer to the microphone.
Put my mouth closer to the microphone.
And speak clearly.
Yorga!
I'm a bookkeeper. Is this better, Robert? Is that Robert or Chuck? Oh, it's Chuck. Oh, no. It's the voice of doom. Okay. Last year, all of us were subjected to a massive media attack culminating in the predetermined re-election of Ronald Reagan. Many people felt and still feel that he does not represent the majority of Americans. And tonight, we would like to present our campaign to unseat the incumbent and elect a person who has better represented our concerns, has proven herself worthy of the position, and though dead for 72 years, is more alive today than her opponent.
And that was
Harriet Tubman, Marcia's hero. You know, we'd say now, I mean, we even talk about the fact that she probably couldn't name the bar the Underground Railroad now in 2022, but in 1982, she could, and she was an ally, and she felt like that was an expression of her support, and it was important to her, and Harriet Tubman was somebody she really respected, and it's, like I said, it was just all about the politics for them.
Yeah. And what else do you want people to know about that time, your podcast, anything that you want to share?
Listen to it. It's really good. It's 8 episodes. We put a lot of love into it. I think, you know, as my mom said, I just really wanted to tell a story about a time and a place that wasn't about the cliche of what you generally think of as hippies. And I hopefully it just people walk away feeling a little more hopeful and a little more
willing to take risks.
Willing to take risks and also just enjoy a good story. It's ultimately, it's a story. And if you like a little true crime, there's some true crime in there. But it's I think it's about hope and it's about risk taking. And we could all use some of that right now.
Yeah. And Karen, what about you?
I think that pretty much sums it up. I have 7 grandchildren right now. And it's terrifying to think about, you know, my father, who was a lifelong leftist, communist, radical person, I remember seeing him on his deathbed, and he looked at me and he said, I always thought I would see it, the revolution, but I'm not going to, but I think you will. And now I'm 73 years old and thinking, oh my God, I can hear myself saying the same thing to my kids, only back in the day, there was a more give and take with the planet, and there's much less of that now. So I'm scared if we don't start, all of us, doing some real risk-taking to change what's happening. So hopefully this will make people feel a little less afraid to take those risks.
I mean, even though you left, obviously, the Back to the Land, it does seem like now that's just more necessary than ever, having, in some ways, like a more low-tech life.
Hey, right now I'm living in upstate New York, as you know, and I am gardening and preparing for the commune that's coming here one of these days. I'm back to the land.
You're back to the land.
Back to, exactly.
Yeah.
And I'll just dream of it for now.
Yeah. How old was your dad, Karen, when he died?
He was 59.
What year was that? Like what decade was that, more or less? I'm just curious.
That would have been 1975.
Do you think that, I feel like there was a time when people really thought they'd see the revolution, and now it's almost like people are afraid they're going to see the end.
Are you afraid of that?
I'm afraid it'll be imminent. Maybe I won't see it, but if I had kids, or if I have kids, they would, or grandkids.
Yeah, I mean, once you, like, I have 2 kids, so you just can't think like that. It's just like, I don't know what that would mean, you know? So it's just, you raise them the best you can, and you just, that's the best you can do.
Probably the only thing I think differently about that, though, James, is that I do think as they age, probably beyond my lifetime, but maybe still in yours, there's going to be some pretty significant climate changes. People need to be prepared for what that could potentially mean.
But I think for me, it's like I have to be hopeful because I have to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am. Otherwise, it's just too dark. It gets too dark. And there's too much darkness already. And I think that's one of the things we enjoyed about making the podcast was that there was a lot of light and dark, so that even when we could see the dark, there was this other part that was very light. And I think that's maybe how I have to just see child raising and living right now, is that there is a lot of darkness, but you have to be able to see the light. Not always easy.
We have to do both. We have to be hopeful, but also make certain changes and adjustments based on what could happen. But without being a downer or a Debbie Downer about it. Just, you know.
Oh, it's all going to be great.
Yeah, it's all going to be great, yeah. Well, thank you, ladies, so much for coming on. And everyone, I really recommend their podcast. And we come on, we can talk about more things.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
At the commune, the next commune. Yeah, thanks so much.
You got it. Thanks, Katie.
Listening to The Katie Halper Show. I'm your host, Katie Halper. You can hear The Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM or WBAI.org. That was Jamie Zellermeyer, a producer and storyteller, and her mother, Karen Zellermeyer, an activist who co-hosts the podcast I Was Never There, which you can find wherever you listen to your podcasts. Before that, I spoke to Representative Ro Khanna. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next week.
Truck drivers, here's a safety tip to note before you go. Trucks turn safest at 5 miles per hour. When turning, make sure there's no pedestrians or cyclists in your blind spots. Help keep New York City streets safer for everyone this holiday season. Visit nyc.gov/TruckSmart.
Greetings. I'm Francesca D'Alessio with the WBAI Community Bulletin Board. The Round Table Studio in Brooklyn is giving away more than 100 Thanksgiving meals. On Thursday, November 24th from 6 p.m. till 9 p.m. at 425 Saratoga Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. For more information, please email theroundtablestudio@gmail.com or give them a call, 805-464-6620. And there's a free Thanksgiving food banquet at the Cornerstone Church located at 59 Cooper Street in Manhattan. That's from 6 till 9 p.m. on Friday, November 25th. There is no charge to attend, but you must pre-register. Go to their website, mycornerstone.org, or contact Nicole at 276-237-2055. Xavier Mission is also hosting free Thanksgiving dinners. They provide nearly 4,000 meals during the holiday week. That's on Thursday, November 24th, and Sunday, November 28th. It's happening at 55 West 15th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues. Doors open at 11:45 a.m. Meals will begin at noon, and it's usually finished by about 1:30. If you are homebound and would like to schedule a delivery, or you just need more information, please call 212-627-2100, extension 211. Or send an email to RDELATORRE at xaviermission.org. The Mission Barrowy also has holiday meals for anyone in need. Hot breakfast will be served between 8 and 9 a.m. and Thanksgiving dinner between 11:30 a.m. and 4 p.m. Outdoor seating will also be available. For more information, please go to their website, bowery.org/get help. And New York Cares has opportunities to volunteer during the holidays. The nonprofit is the largest volunteer network in New York City. It offers thousands of volunteer opportunities with nonprofits and schools in all five boroughs. Thanksgiving volunteers are needed with organizations that address issues like hunger, homelessness, educational inequity, and the environment. For more information, go to their website, newyorkcares.org. And the annual Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade starts at 9 a.m. on Thursday, November 24th. Enjoy balloons, marching bands, floats, clowns, performances, and of course, Santa. The 2.5-mile route stretches from the Upper West Side to Midtown, starting at West 77th Street, ending at Macy's Herald Square on 34th Street. For more information, mevents@macys.com. If you have an event you'd like to share with us, please email cbb@wbai.org. For the WBAI Community Bulletin Board, I'm Francesca D'Alessio.
Well, Mark, time to watch the frogs eating the flies.
Yep, then off to the neighbors to watch the paint dry.
Mr. Wilson, the trains are coming.
Land sakes, it's the Arts Express pulling into the station with goodies for all of us.
Oh, well, it's about time. Looky, there's presents for everyone.
Look, Pa, it's a preview of the latest indie feature.
And more, it's an interview with a major Broadway theater actor.
And I got some shiny new film reviews from film festivals all over the world.
And here's cutting-edge poetry from the country's most progressive poet.
Oh, sweet Lord, it's a miracle.
No, it's not. It's Arts Express with host Prairie Miller.
That's Arts Express with host Prairie Miller at our new day and time, Wednesdays at 9 p.m. on WBAI FM New York.
And the previous program was The Katie Halper Show, heard Wednesdays at 3 p.m. here on WBAI New York and 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Sojourner Truth coming up in the next hour. And while that show is on the air, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station. 212-209-2950 is the number, 212-209-2950, or go to give to WBAI.org online. That's give to the number 2 WBAI.org online. Yeah, I could go into the spiel about the importance of the radio station, but by this point, you should know now how important and how vital an institution like WBAI is. So, and also, anytime I go into any kind of extended thought, any type of stream of consciousness regarding to the station, almost guarantees me that I will get some kind of notification from management, so I will not go there.